said, no, I like Lutheran answers because we need a response to Catholic answers, but
yeah,
nobody's doing it. And I was like, well, I mean, that was my original goal, but dude, blog posts, articles, Q&A, podcasts, videos, like it's so much content and I have a full-time job, you know, it's
yeah, the,
too much.
The problem
so.
I've run into is any group project. If you've been in school before and you have a group project, you usually got one guy who does all the work. I've tried cooperating with other people on stuff before. And, a lot of times it's like, hey, are you ever going to get me that thing? You know, you're supposed to record a response to this question like last week. And they say, well, you know, I just had two baptisms and a funeral and stuff. And yet, you know, you have to understand that people are going to be busy, but at the same time, like sooner or later, I was like, you know what? That's my thing. This channel, I got my dad to do the intro music for mine, the bump music, and I paid some guy on Fiverr. I paid him to, you know, and I worked out the logo and I did a little bit of tweaking on it. But at the end of the day, I'm like, all right, well. You see, Rev Wolf Miller, he's got his thing. He records, you know, he Sunday drive home or whatever. And I'm like, all right, well, I could do that. I mean, a lot of pastors can do that. If I've already written this sermon, all I'm doing is recording it and sharing it with another audience. So I said, all right, well, you know, the amount of benefit that I could get from sharing my sermon in a second source versus the amount of extra effort I would have to put in for a sermon that I already wrote. It's just, I mean, there was no reason not to do it, especially since, you know, COVID, everyone's online. But so I've told other pastors to do the same thing, but they're like, I record my sermon in the pulpit anyway. So I record my entire service. I'm like, yeah, but you don't have like a whole like alter ego that you know, you jump into online.
Do you mind if I like link this to your YouTube channel and all that?
Sure.
That
okay? I mean, yeah, I could put it up there or link it. Yeah. I saw your YouTube videos. I went on your, that was the first thing I did. I'm like,
I need to make
like
more 30 of those.
Seconds
those
long,
are great.
Like 15 seconds long. I was like, it's not, I mean, I saw the length first and I thought, how is this guy getting his responses down to like 15 seconds? I gotta get on that train. That's about the attention span that you can hold.
Yeah, well, so like I when I first started doing those, it was because my brother Ray is he's a wonderful guy. He's a Baptist. God bless him. I'm in the South, so we all are, except me, you know. But he posted some video on Facebook and was this long, long video about, is the coin shortage a sign of the end times? And it was really thoughtful, really well done. All this like biblical exegesis that he did, that was really, he handled the book of Revelation with great care. And it was just a wonderful video, but it was like 25, 30 minutes long. And I was like, damn, it's a lot easier to just say no. You know, like,
yeah.
Because that's where you end up at the end of the day. So I just thought, well, I'll do that. And so then I made, and people love them. I need to make more. People think they're funny.
Well, that was originally, my thought was, okay, I end up, so I spend an inordinate amount of time on the internet arguing with people of different denominations and beliefs. And I found that same. I would keep running into the same sort of arguments over and over. So, I mean, Facebook, I would recommend nobody ever use it. It's just, you know, hive of scum and villainy. But especially those Lutheran groups on Facebook, you know, I love the Lutherans in there, but there are a lot of people in there who have nothing to do but just be angry with one another. And then, yeah. But
I saw a guy in one of those groups the other day who, you know how they do the polls, you know, which way do you face when you say the whatever? And they have the, and then the third option is always Semper Virgo. And they do that because they're saying adiaphora, right? Like it doesn't matter. Just, you know, whatever works for you. That's why they put, because Semper Virgo itself is adiaphora. And so that's what they're saying there. It's just, it doesn't matter. I saw a dude actually trying to argue against Semper Virgo because it was one of the poll options on the Facebook. I was like, bro, do you not get the joke? Have you not been here?
Yeah, we would do that in a seminary. I don't know if you're still planning on going to were you going to St. Louis or were you interested?
No, I'm in the AALC.
Okay, yeah.
So I will be going –
Fort Wayne campus.
I will be going to ALTS. Yeah, I will be going to ALTS online, which is shared with Fort Wayne.
Yeah,
that should be in about
Cooper
a year.
Cooper is there. Yeah, yeah. We had
Cooper's.
He's
our president.
I think he moved there before. Or he moved there after I graduated. So I've never had the opportunity to meet him in person. I mean,
I don't know. I don't know that he lives up there.
Well, yeah, that's the other thing is I don't know. I mean, I've seen him his office from the inside, but I have no clue where he is aside from that. I know that there is an AALC office on campus. I think my father-in-law.
So that's actually our like home office. Or whatever, the LCMS was kind enough to let us borrow a portion of Fort Wayne. And that's actually the office you saw was probably Dr. Lines, the president of the AALC.
I think
that was probably his office.
Yeah, they had a sign to the AALC. Oh, you know, the other Lutherans are here.
That's we're like headquartered. Yeah, we're like headquartered out of Fort Wayne. We have a nice working relationship, I think, with the LCMS. We're an altar and pulpit fellowship. We actually in the AALC, I mean, I don't know if it's a problem necessarily, but we need pastors because we have a lot of AALC churches that don't have pastors, but we have a lot of pastors that are staffing LCMS churches right now. And it's like,
No, I saw, I think Dr. Cooper had a video on, it was a while back, he had a video on why doesn't the AALC join the LCMS. And, you know, I was curious too. I think he explained it. He said, well, you know, there's the historical development, even though the doctrine is the same, the historical development is different and it's worth preserving that there was this, you know, it turns out, parallel sort of line of Lutheran development. Just shows how right we are as Lutherans. And I said, you know what? Fine. That makes perfect sense to me.
I think a lot of ALC.
I think I'll stick with LCMS for a while until I get kicked out for denying Semper Virgo. Well, to be fair, I don't deny Semper Virgo. I don't affirm or deny it. I specifically take whichever position is going to cause the most consternation. But I have been called a heretic more on that issue than any other.
Yeah, that's a wild issue. I think a lot of times when it comes to like Semper Virgo debates in person, I hold to whatever position is going to get me out of this conversation the fastest.
There's always beer involved in these conversations. When you're on Facebook, it's not as much fun.
There has
fun.
To be.
Yeah.
No. I'm just, my wife asked me to stop drunkenly shouting at my computer. And I, you know.
Yeah, you got to do that in person. That's the issue. That's the issue that will divide the synod. Nothing important, but that issue specifically.
It's wild. It's wild how a lot of people, I think a lot of people want to be trad for trad's sake.
Yeah.
Right. Yep. And they don't, like, they don't actually care whether or not the position is theologically correct or theologically sound. They just want to be. And I think that's why we lose a lot of people to Rome or to the East. I think more to the East than to Rome.
Yeah.
Because you can have your tradition and not your Pope. So it's great.
No, that's what we were, I mean, again, going back to, that was what we were told at seminary is, the Smells and Bells crowd goes over, you know, to the East and, the ones who can't quite stand the ELCA go over to Rome and end up doing Novus Ordo over there. Yeah.
It's so sad because like we have truth over here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Truth isn't always, it ends up taking a second fiddle to identity. And I guess there's not enough identity to be found in I believe the truth. There's more identity to be found in I'm a rad trad who believes rad trad stuff that happens to be true.
Pride.
It is. And and this is one of the reasons, I mean, I don't want to say that there's a noble reason why I pick the fight of Semper Virgo as often as I do, because most of the time it's just entertainment. But a lot of the time it's, I'm uncovering idols. What I perceive as idols. Now, again, not saying, you know, Semper Virgo is absolutely true or false, but the fact that if you ask the question, why do you believe this? The answers are sometimes concerning. Sometimes it's just, the answer I usually get is, Martin Luther believed it. Well, yeah, Martin Luther believed a lot of things. We don't subscribe to the doctrine of sola Luther, you know, we subscribe.
Right.
And they said, well, how can you deny this pious? And that's the word that's thrown in all the time, this pious doctrine. It's pious. How can you deny it? It's pious. And so, well, just saying the word pious over and over doesn't make it. It's like, I declare bankruptcy. No, you have to actually go, right. I declare it. It's like, I declare Semper Virgo is pious. It's like, yes, but show where this doctrine came from. And some of the people who've done some of the digging, I really respect how they've come to their conclusion. And I'll one of the sources for this doctrine is the Proto-Evangelion of James. It's a pseudepigraphal book. It's a book that we wouldn't take any information from otherwise, but it says all of this stuff like it affirms like clause of utero and all these other things, that Mary was pregnant and then there was a flash of light and behold, she was holding the Christ child. And Salome was there for some reason. And she verified that physically that Mary was still pregnant or Mary was still was fit the virgin requirements or whatever. And with this information we get from this book that we wouldn't trust otherwise. So my initial thought was, okay, well, let's just not trust it, right? But the competent argument I've seen made from that is they say, well, look, the fact that this pseudepigraphal account was written and that so many people still believe this thing afterwards shows that it was a common enough belief in the Christian church early on. So I say, okay, maybe there was somebody who knew Joseph or Mary and maybe they got this information and it wasn't written down and it very well could have been true. It very well could have been true, but most people never dig to find the source of the doctrine. And they'll just say, well, here's a list of church fathers who believed it. Here's a way that you can translate the word brother to mean cousins or half-brothers or whatever, which I think that's a completely different argument, just because, you know, even if Jesus didn't have any subsequent siblings from Mary, doesn't necessarily mean that they didn't have a biblical marriage, Joseph and Mary. But it's so quickly just used as a jumping off point to say, look, here I am believing this pious traditional thing, and here you are, and I'm going to ascribe to you every negative aspect that I can. So I was called a contemporary worship modernist. I was called a postmodernist and a modernist. Somebody called me a heretic and told me I should review my cult documents. They said, "Wow, you see the small cult articles refer to her as the ever Virgin Mary and stuff." But it was this thing where I was asking a question. So, okay, so why is this belief real? How, you know, I assume you being ALC, you're a fan of Dr. Jordan Cooper. I watch his videos religiously, but he will go back and he's got all these books on his shelf and he'll say, well, here's this, you know, Antinician church father. And he'll find this quote and he'll say, you know, this is the origin and this is the first time we could find a prayer to Mary or whatever. And he'll go back and he'll look at the origin. And it shouldn't be a controversial topic to say, show me where your belief comes from. It's not enough simply to say, look, these other holy people believed it. That can add to its credibility. But if you can't show the source of it, then you've got an issue that you have to wrestle with. You have to be able to say, well, maybe there's a good source, maybe there's not a good source. Adiaphora is probably the appropriate solution to that. But it's still fun to argue.
I commented, I think on one of your YouTube videos about like, I believe it, but I'm not going to fight you about it, you know?
Yeah.
I grew up like rabid Protestant, Pentecostal holiness. And just
so you don't like Mary is what you're saying, right?
Yeah. Well, anything to do with Catholicism. No.
Yeah.
Growing up. No, didn't like it at all. And it almost came down to like an insult contest against Mary when Semper Virgo is brought up. And I don't know, maybe it's just reactionary out of that, where I'm just like, well, you know what? This is something that's, if it's true, is a good thing. And it's not like, it's not a bad thing. It's to what great dedication to the Lord. And so, you know, if it's a way that I can, Mary's due some honor, right? She's due some, and as Lutherans, I think we have a hard time with that. The Catholics go like, they like full in, crank the dial to 11. Let's dive in.
You see, it's the difference between latria and hyperdulia. And it's like, yes, we worship her, but not the way that it's a different word for worship. And there's this like minute distinction that, you know, yeah.
Well, in practice, that distinction disappears. It's a verbal only distinction. But I mean, at the end of the day, though, like Mary is due some kind of honor and respect. If nothing else, though, the one thing the Catholics nail dead on is that Mary is, and I suppose Christ himself, who knows, this is all beyond our comprehension, I think, as people. But in some ways, she's like the ark, right? Carrying the new covenant, carrying Christ within her. And I don't know, man, like that's important. That's something we shouldn't just gloss over, I think. So
yeah, it's like,
I don't know.
And Luther does this all the time in his sermons. Is he'll sometimes it feels like he just makes these things up, and he'll make a comparison between two things that seem otherwise unconnected, right. But then he spins it into this thing where comparing Mary to the Ark, and what would that imagery be able to tell you about, you know, what are the similarities between it, Mary and the new Eve, you know, what's the difference between Mary and Eve and the faithfulness that they showed or didn't show. That's one of the ones that I like to use a lot, seeing that, you know, from Eve, all his sin came, and then from Mary, we have the one, you know, through one man, sin entered the world, and then death, and through one man, you know, Jesus, the process is reversed. But then it gets kind of complicated, because you can only take the analogy so far, because if Mary is the new Eve and Jesus is the new Adam, then that gets a little weird. And
So Jesus, this is one of my favorite things about Jesus. He's God. Okay. So
that's a little important. Yeah.
Yeah. But he never misspeaks, right? Everything he says is perfect. He doesn't misspeak. He says the thing that he needs to say the way it should be said. And we see this, you can only take the analogy so far before it breaks down, because we're talking about things that are beyond earth, that are beyond reality as we know it, as we are able to comprehend it. And so, like, you see this a lot in the parables where the analogy breaks down, you know? So it's like the wedding feast where, like, the people don't show up. So then he goes out and just any beggar on the street come in and eat and all this. And then finally the guests show up, and it's like, so the master that was throwing the feast, because they were late, decided to throw them into outer darkness where there was weeping and gnashing of teeth. And it's like, well, that doesn't. I've never had that happen to me, you know. Yeah, so like, it kind of breaks down at the end.
Yeah, that just means deathbed conversions all go to hell. That's the proper exegetical step to take there.
Official LCMS doctrine. You heard it here, folks.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm gonna put that into a Book of Concord too. Electric Boogaloo.
I often ask my charismatic friends when they were like, when they say, like, they'll post something, you know, like Instagram, and it's like, oh, the Lord spoke to me this morning and said, you know, X, Y, Z.
Right, right.
And I'll just to be, you know, a jerk, I'll be like, cool, can I write that into my Bible? I got some blank pages in the back. Is that what they're for?
Oh boy. Yeah. The margins. That's why you get the, you know, the note Bibles or whatever. They have that, all the extra space that people draw on the side. Yeah. You're supposed to write your verses in there. You know, God's speaking to you in your, you know,
yeah, you're the new Testament.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Then we get into Mormon territory. Yeah. Well, and the other problem is, how do you write feelings down? Because sometimes it's, I feel like the Lord wants me to, I get a feeling Lord wants, you know, I feel. If you've watched Chris Roseborough before,
Roseborough. He's AALC.
Yeah, he's he does. He was part of the inspiration behind my behind my channel. But he'll talk about how the ineffective Holy Spirit, where he can kind of communicate, but not really. Like everything is better in the New Covenant, except the Holy Spirit just can't really talk. He just kind of goes, "I want to give you a feeling."
Yeah.
No, I saw he had so he had the pirates locked down, the pirate thing. His whole thing was pirate Christian radio. And then, of course, Fisk had the ninjas locked down. And I thought, well, you know what? Nobody's claimed paladins yet. So I staked my claim on paladins. And so that's
the pagans. The pagans grabbed Vikings.
Oh, they grab. They can have Vikings. If you read the stories of Odin and stuff, they're not all. They're not all great.
They're not great.
Yeah. It's like Zeus or whatever. It's like, he wasn't, I mean, I've seen the Disney movie. That's fun. But that in their own stories, he's not a good guy.
No. And I had one of those Facebook arguments one time, and the person said, they were like, oh, you know, our pagan gods are so great or whatever. And like, never mind the fact that if Disney holds the copyright on your god, like your religion is lame, dude.
Yeah.
Lame. But he said something about the only reason we don't know more about pagan mythology is because you Christians burned everything.
Oops.
And I said, yeah. Well, I said, actually, we did it, believe it or not. Boniface cut down a tree, and then they said, oh, so I guess our gods are fake, because he wasn't immediately struck by lightning. Yeah. So they all converted, and they actually brought their own books out to burn. And Boniface and the Catholic Church said, no, we want to preserve your history. Don't burn your books. And they were like, well, nah, it's all fake anyway. And so they burned their own books. We didn't burn their books.
Yeah.
That was just a result of conversion.
Yeah, that happens sometimes. It's interesting. If you go back, it's all portrayed as, well, depending on who's portraying it, it's portraying as, you know, you Christians came in and conquered, and, you know, St. Patrick killed all the pagans in Ireland or something like that. And it's like, no, I mean, we actually do have some recorded history of what happened. And the conversion is often, you know, the, okay, well, we'll burn our idols because they're obviously idols, and let's follow your, you know. Mm-hmm. And you've got accounts of that in the Bible as well, where you've got people who are leaving other cultures and being kind of adopted into Christianity, or the Old Testament version of Christianity. But yeah,
which I just call Christianity, just to upset people.
Well, that's what I mean. Yeah. I specifically use terms like that. You can, the Old Testament Christians, and whether or not they knew, well, they would have, well, I guess Christ, there would have been Messiah ends. I guess, I don't know, that Christ is just the Greek version of the Hebrew word for word Messiah. It's literally just the chosen anointed one, which, I've heard people call them all Yahwists before, but, like, okay. I mean, I just refer to them as the faith. If I have to give a sermon and I'm referring to the people in the Old Testament, I just call them the faithful. If I'm picking a fight with somebody, I might call them the Christians. But then again, I found if you want to pick a fight with the right guys, and I'm not saying to pick a fight. I'm just saying is all I'm saying. If you happen to refer to Martin Luther as a church father, there are some people who take offense to that for some reason. But I think it fits, right? He was a padre, because we've got the Antonicene church fathers, and, you know, so he's just the, you know, the Reformation church father. He's just, you know, he's one of them, right?
I'm fine with that. I'm fine. I'm fine with, so here's the thing, like, I'm willing to define patristics, like, mathematically as like this year minus 200 is patristic theology. Anything from 1822 back, I'm going to call you a church father, because you're out of living memory at that point. So let's go.
And for some reason or another, your theology has persisted. Either it's heretical and we're keeping it to laugh at, or, you know, there's actually like, you know, I got Pieper and stuff back there. There's some of them that are, they wrote some things worth reading. You don't have to be super old to do that, it turns out.
I'm finishing my undergrad at Liberty University, and it's always fun to be the Lutheran at the Baptist College. I quote so much Pieper, because you can't, he's too smart. I just hands down. Okay. I don't know like when theologians dropped off. I don't know when that happened. I think there are a few theologians that are very, very good modern day theologians that I would put on par with church fathers. Brian Wolfmuller, probably up there, right? Like there's a few of them that are good, but I don't know. Like it's just dropped off and I don't know. Maybe it's always been like this. You know, I haven't been around to know, but I have to use Pieper and I lean on him so much in like my papers and stuff because like you can't argue with him. He's too smart. You just can't argue with him. You're not going to win.
Yeah. And he's dealing with a lot of the same arguments that we're encountering today. You'll have maybe towards the end of Luther's life and, you know, some of Melanchthon and Chemnitz and stuff deal with a lot of the enthusiasts, the people who become the Calvinists and Reformed. But most of the work that they've dealt with is, you know, Roman Catholic theology. When we get to the Americas, and later on, a lot of it is, you know, this American brand of sort of Baptist, Calvinist, Reformed, sort of Methodist offshoot theology. And I guess this is the new frontier. We have yet to get to a place where the Lutherans have really gone toe to toe with the Eastern Orthodox. But I think, I mean, at least so far, there's enough documentation between Lutherans and Roman Catholics, and Lutherans and, you know, Reformed Baptists and stuff I think we have so many theologians that eventually over time we realize that some of them are brilliant and not all of them. And that's what I'm hoping is that God is continuing to kind of place these brilliant theologians in every few generations. And then we'll get a book and we'll read it. And of course, you know, me being LCMS, I'm going to say, oh, well, we've got, you know, David Scare. And he's, if anybody's familiar with him, he's this theologian that everybody's familiar. And he's taught, you know, been teaching for decades and decades, but and his writings on baptism and some of the best explanations of Christian baptism I've ever read in any of these books. But I'd like to think that God continues to sprinkle brilliant theologians in here and there, and we keep discovering them. And say, oh, this guy's great! I can't wait to, you know, read everything that he writes. And yeah, yeah.
Unfortunately, that's none of like the 50 people listening to my podcast.
Yeah, who knows? I don't know.
They're like, oh, this guy is there.
Yeah.
He's out there. He's saying things.
Yep. Just scream into the void loud enough and the void will echo back.
That's the plan. That's the plan. I think I actually had that conversation with Feeney.
Yeah, it has to start somewhere. Feeney, I think I listened to your interview with Feeney, and he said something along the same lines. And if you pay attention to the way Lutheran satire started out, is, I mean, now it's this huge thing, but when it started out, it was just, you know, he's making jokes and it's this little thing, and it grows. I mean, looking back at, I'll scroll back to Dr. Cooper's original videos. I mean, past the ones with the yo-yo ones, those are cool. But when you get to like the original videos on his channel, because nobody ever scrolls to the first few videos, but they're like, you know, four to 50 views. And then you go to these ones now and you get thousands of people watching these videos, and you just see how much God has blessed his ministry over these years that he's continued to just do it. And it's never turned into some sort of gimmicky thing with a lot of these guys. It's just persistence. I mean, Worldview Everlasting, that was going on for a while. I was watching Worldview Everlasting when it was a bunch of different pastors, and I know they kind of split up and they're doing their own things now. But there's something to be said with, I mean, everybody thinks you have to be a movie star to you know, you have to start at 10,000 subscribers, but that's never the case of anybody I've ever seen in any of these theologians. They're always, okay, well, I'm already doing my sermon. I may as well share my sermon with other people. And eventually you've got, you know, somebody tells somebody, hey, you know, you can get the truth here. This is useful. And it grows. So I try to encourage other pastors, as much as I can, to say, hey, You've already done your work on your sermon. If you've already written a Bible study, record it, because someone out there with a 7-minute attention span would love to have access to what you give on Sunday, because you worked hard for that. Yeah. And now that we have the internet, that's how people learn. That's how people come into church. They find your church on Google Maps, and they've seen your sermons on, you know, on your Facebook page. I don't think it's necessarily the evil of technology. I think we can embrace this tool that God has given us to reach more people, as long as we don't let it compromise our faith and our content.
I think another key to internet pastoring is pushing people to real pastoring.
Yes.
You know,
yes. Videos are not a substitute for having a pastor.
Exactly. And emailing some guy from the internet is not a substitute for having a pastor. And every internet pastor I know that does a good job at it will always tell you, hey, go talk to your pastor about this. If you don't have one, I'll find you one. But like, I'm not the guy you need to talk to about, you know, whatever your divorce or whatever you're going through. That's, you know, that's someone else.
Yeah.
So I that's important. And In that way, it's good, because it helps this sort of international platform helps us grow locally as we grow sort of globally, right?
Right, right. Well, and it's almost a degree of brand recognition as well. Somebody who's not a Christian at all, if they're not a Christian, they're not going to know what a Lutheran is unless they live in the Midwest. And they start seeing, you know, they start listening to podcasts, and they start watching videos and stuff about theology. And they say, wow, I never thought about it this way. Or, wow, this is great. This leads me to either continue to watch or listen, or hopefully to start reading the Bible. And how do I get more of this? And if they can find out that this is available at every Lutheran church, hopefully, then they don't have to have a single podcast that they watch, you know, once a week or something, or listen to once a week. They say, well, I get to go to a church and I get to interact with all kinds of people who believe that, and the pastor who, you know, the pastor who can explain that exact same topic. It's fantastic. If they're not being funneled towards local churches, the temptation is often, I don't need to go to church. I can watch it online.
Yeah.
That's why I don't live stream my whole service. The sermon's going online.
So but, we do. And we're divided on this as a church. I spearheaded the live stream because I'm the, you know, I do like web design and stuff. I have a podcast. So like, I'm the default tech guy.
Yeah.
And so like, I spearheaded this live stream, me and another guy, but like, now the more I think about it, the more I wish we didn't live stream our sermon at all, because so many people really do just stay home for no reason.
That's the question. And I don't think that we could have necessarily answered that going in. I think so. COVID made for a lot of pastors, the LCMS was funding. It was actually, they had programs to fund, you know, webcams and live streaming. So they'll help you set these things up. And the question then that developed after that is, okay, well, we're live streaming our entire services. If people don't completely understand, if they don't understand the sacraments, if we're not clear that you have to be here to receive the sacraments, if we're not clear on the benefits of going to church and having fellowship with your fellow Christians, if you don't understand that these are all blessings that you need to be in church to receive, whether it's a building or meeting in a, you know, the catacombs or whatever, people will say, well, I get everything I need on YouTube. And by the way, I can speed it up to 1.75% or 1.75 times speed. And that's what I do with all my videos. And I can get more sermon per hour than the people who go to church.
Which blows my mind. Cause like at our church, we're in and out in like 54 minutes. So I don't know.
I try to keep my sermons. At the most, they'll be if I've really got something that I have to bring home, it can go as long as 20 minutes. But I've seen pastors do brilliantly with more and brilliantly with less. A lot of it, the pastor has to know their congregation. They have to know, okay, what's the attention span of this congregation? how much can I give them? In the homiletics class, we would talk about, you know, there's only so many things you can juggle at a time. You hand somebody a ball, it's like a concept. They get it. You can hand somebody two, they get it. When you get them three, it starts getting difficult until you can find how they're all connected. So you have to limit the amount of content, and it has to be directed. It has to be finely chiseled. Like, what's your point? And how are all these other things you're saying connected to the point? But I think each pastor knows it's a family. Each family, they know best, you know, this congregation. If you go to Fort Wayne or you go to St. Louis, there are congregations out there that can juggle all of these $5 Latin theological terms, without dropping the ball. And they're just used to that. And then there's other congregations you go to and they need a more direct, simple approach. And then they'll go and they'll chew on what you give them or what God gives them for the rest of the week. So you can't say, oh, well, you know, your sermon was only 10 minutes. It wasn't enough. No, for this congregation, it was enough because mentally they continue to process it. But it depends on the congregation, and it depends on, and the pastor has to be able to kind of figure that out. And feedback is helpful, but it's also dangerous to ask for feedback.
dangerous for the pride, I think.
In both ways. I would say you've got a congregation that loves you and they say, yeah, sermon was fantastic, you're like, yeah, it was fantastic because I'm a fantastic pastor.
Right.
the opposite of that, of course, being, you know, you say, I want feedback on it, and pastor, that sermon was boring and I hated it. And it's like, okay, well, it hurt my feelings, but I can't improve.
I'm not a real person anyway. It's fine.
I only work 1 hour a week as it is. You know, I just,
that's it. Yeah.
Do origami or paper airplanes the rest of the time. Throw origami boulders into my trash can. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is a set. This is just a flat wall right here. There's no books. There's lighting up. But I'm on the beach.
Painted.
Right now. Yeah. It's
I like painted. That you took the time when you had the artist paint all of those fake books in the background. You took the time to make sure they were all CPH books. That's
attention to detail. They've got, unfortunately, I've got some shelves that I have to clean up. Because I've got some books I need to get. There's a stamp that I've seen people use where it says heresy, don't read. And I need to get those because I've got a few books here that are just like it's like my 7 minutes dead. I've been dead for 7 minutes or whatever. And I met God, like those kind of things, like heaven is real and purpose driven life. And these other books that people say, you know, you've got to read this book. It's changed my life. And you know it's heresy before you even open up. You're like, yeah, I know that guy, and he writes, everything he writes is trash. But you have to know you have to read trash sometimes to know what the people, because the people will come to you and they'll say, look, here's a purpose-driven life. They sell more copies than anything but the Bible. It must be good. What do you think about it? And if you're not familiar with it, then you're going to have either an answer that's going to offend them. You say, it's stupid, I'm not going to read it because I hate Rick Warren. It's popular, therefore it must be good. You know, I'm sure somebody would have called him out if it was something bad. And that's the difficult part, is having extra time to wade through things that you would not read on purpose. Like you go into it knowing that there's going to be some objectionable content to it.
Right.
But I did that what was that?
I was going to say how as a pastor, how do you deal with that when someone comes to you and they're like, Reverend, I read The Shack and it changed my life. Like, what do you do?
Well, I'll tell you what am I supposed to do, or what have I done? I've definitely, in the past, and this was a mistake I made. I mean, I haven't been a pastor for that long, but I've already made my share of mistakes. Somebody came in, and it was a purpose-driven life, and somebody noticed it on the shelf. And this is, you know, I inherited the bookshelf from the previous pastor and I've added my own. And they said, oh, you know, something about the, I gestured behind me. I said, yeah, we've got some heretical stuff. I don't want to gesture to people when I say that, but you know, there's some books over here, you know, some heretical nonsense. And I gestured to it. And they said, oh, a purpose-driven life. I've read that. I'm like, ah, it's trash or something. And then I offended these people terribly. And it was awful because I didn't realize, I put my foot so far into my mouth. I didn't realize that this person had come in, and this was, you know, they were at the stage where they needed milk, not meat. They couldn't chew on that. And I knew only enough about the book to know it was bad. I've read snippets of it here and there, but I hadn't read it cover to cover. So I couldn't tell them. And if they had said, well, you know, I like this part or I like that part, I would have been completely ignorant. I couldn't have said, you know, this is the good stuff. This is the bad stuff. This is the stuff, whatever. But there are so many bad books out there and so many books that are good and bad that you can't read them all, especially if you're reading a lot of good theology. So you have to pick and choose. I would say that I very poorly handled the purpose-driven life conversation, very poorly. And in the future, what I want to do is I want to go through it and do something called the purpose-given life. And I want to contrast. Mm. I want to go page by page, chapter by chapter, and contrast the kind of works righteousness, fruit checking stuff with the your value comes from God. But I haven't had the time to do that yet. I did get through the Jordan Peterson books. I don't know if you've read those or not. Mm. So he's got, are you familiar with Jordan Peterson? He's a Canadian psychologist.
Yeah, I see he's sort of thinking himself around to Jesus, which I think is pretty cool.
It's fascinating to watch the journey, and he's honest enough that you can watch the progress. And I think people are jumping the gun a lot when they're saying, well, see, he's Christian. There's clips of him talking about it where he's frustrated because he thinks on one hand, the latest I saw was it's undeniable that, he knows that, you know, Jesus is real, but he thinks that there is, and he talks about it as a historical event and kind of a mythos, a theology, a greater philosophical concept being married together in this Jesus character. Or yes, he was a historical figure, but at the same time, his mere existence suggests some sort of mythological or theological thing, and he has to come to grips with it. So he doesn't. Mm-hmm. I don't think he's yet at the stage where he says the Bible is God's word and it is true. He's at the stage where, and I don't think this is the right stage. I think it's Carl Jungian philosophy. I'm not a fan of Jung, where he says, "Well, it is the embodiment of truth. It is so." It is so important that it may as well be true. It's one of these, like, I don't even know how to describe it. Like this, I don't know, this truth that transcends. It's so important of a story that it doesn't matter if it really happened or not, because the moral is what we have to get from it. But
so I think he's at the place where he's looking at this and he's saying, how can this not be true? Like, mm-hmm. he doesn't necessarily believe it, but like, how can I not be believing this? This has to be believed. But he's now wrestling with, if I believe this, what does that mean for me?
Exactly. Right? And it's not something where he can dip a toe in. You have to, mm-hmm. you're in or out. You either believe or you don't. And yeah, the video,
especially
I saw,
his personality type, right?
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, is if something is true, then he believes that he has a moral obligation to believe that it is true. So if he comes to the conclusion that this is, and this is something where he's teetering on the edge of the pool, and he's looking down into the water, not knowing how deep it is, and not knowing if he can swim, and not knowing what will happen if he falls in. I think I'm thinking of the same interview. He says he's terrified of the consequences of if it is true, because if the Bible is true, then this tells you not only a lot about Jesus, but this tells you about yourself and the universe and the purpose behind things and sin and everything else. So I pray for him. From what I've seen so far, I don't know if there's any further development. I believe his wife is Christian at this point, and she wasn't before. And I think God is working through him. And I think it's actually a real benefit for Christians not to look at him and say, look at this guy, he's a Christian, and look at how smart he is, therefore we got the good guys on our side, but to look at the honesty and the self-examination that he's going through this, and these are the conflicts that somebody will go through, and they'll say, well, if this is true, what does this mean? How does this apply to me? And people can really resonate with that, and they say, I've struggled with these same questions too, and the fact that this genius doctor is struggling with these things and not just jumping in and saying it's true, it's false, I think it's a benefit to people, and encouraging to people to say, keep reading the Bible, keep talking with pastors, keep getting into the theology, because you haven't gotten to the bottom of it yet.
It's interesting. He actually recently followed Dr. Cooper on Twitter.
Oh, that's fantastic. I've been waiting for that crossover episode for a long time.
Yeah.
Dr. Jordan B in YouTube, and they've got competing channels.
I saw a video of him on the TikTok, which is, you say Facebook is awful. Don't even go near TikTok. It's terrible. It's unreal. All I do is watch cat videos. I'm a big cat person. And all I do is like watch these cat videos, but like you still, they inundate you with like trash. Almost like forcefully. But I saw a video of Peterson on there, and it's just some like a student filming a lecture of his like at college. And he shows this graph of the Bible, and it's all of the verses of the Bible on a line graph and all the different connections and intersections that every verse has. And it's massive. It's mind blowing. And he's pointing to this and he's saying, this is a book written by dozens of different people over thousands of years. How is this possible? How can you have this cohesive of a narrative in one book written by people that were separated by hundreds of years? How? It's not possible.
And there's nothing to compare it to. There's no other religion that has anything even remotely comparable. If you have like the closest thing you have is, you know, the Jewish Lord of the Rings. Yeah. Well, but that's written by one guy and then the rest of the stuff. Yeah. But and then Peter Jackson comes. But I mean, so you've got like the rab, and these are different rabbis over a period of time, and they would disagree with one another. There isn't coherence between all of these rabbis who study, you know, in these various Jewish Judaisms, these various sects. Any other major religion, you've got Islam, you have the Quran, which obviously it wasn't written directly by Muhammad, but it was essentially dictated from Muhammad, and then the later hadiths are written by, you know, his followers, Sahih al-Bukhari, Sahih Muslim, all these other ones. But those disagree with each other, which is why even in Islam, you'll have different groups. I mean, Sunni and Shia is a big division, but you've got these different groups of these different people who will say, well, these books are not authority. It would be if somebody said, well, I don't, you know, Matthew and Romans and Ephesians, those are not authoritative, but Mark and John or whatever. So there's no coherency like there is with the Bible, the Christian, I mean, there are some divisions when you get to, you know, what about the Deuterocanon, the Apocrypha and the Old Testament, or in the New Testament, what about the distinction between the homologomena and the antilegomena, or I'm probably saying it wrong, but you know, there's distinctions between the books, but it's never to this point where it's never like, well, I know the joke is that Luther tried to take all these books out of the Bible. He tried to rip these books out of the Bible. And, you know, thankfully those Catholics prevented him from ripping the books out of the Bible. But
by adding them after the Reformation. Yeah, I just want to point that out for anyone that doesn't know. Anyone that doesn't know, those books, the Apocrypha was declared canonical after the Reformation. For anyone that doesn't know that. That was not something Luther removed. That was something the Catholics added. Okay.
To be fair, Saint Jerome, the translator of the Latin Vulgate, he used the term. He made the distinction between the Deuterocanon and the Old Testament canon. He referred to them as Apocrypha. And if people will proof text Jerome, and they'll say, "Well, look here, he rejected these books," and later on he says, "No, he accepted these books." His position and his explanation of them changed over time. But he and plenty others noticed that there was a difference between these books that ended with Malachi and the books that were written in the intertestamental period by unknown authors and unconfirmed sources. Sources, and some of them containing things that we believe are not true. There is some difference there. I mean, Luther still said that he translated them to German as well. They were included in the in the Lutheran Bible, the German version of the Lutheran Bible. You can get a CPH copy of the Apocrypha. I don't know if I've got mine here.
I have one,
but yeah, no, it's at home, I think. But yeah, he says that the Christians ought to read them, if for nothing else than a historical understanding of what happened in between these two things. But even still, like, that's not, that's nothing compared to these other religions where, you know, they'll say, well, this prophet was, it would be like, say, yeah, the Apostle John was, you know, don't listen to anything he wrote. That's the equivalent in Islam when they say, well, don't listen to Sahih al-Bukhari or don't listen to Bukhari,
right,
because everything he wrote was nonsense. And it's, but the, yeah, the coherency,
it's interesting.
The coherency of the Bible is solid.
It's interesting to me because just listening to you talk about this, I realize that the textual critical view of scripture that the ELCA and the more mainline liberal denominations take, that's like they have to work. They have to really fight to get textual criticism to be accepted as a valid interpretation of scripture. Whereas with things like Islam or even rabbinical Judaism, textual criticism is like your starting point.
Yeah.
We all just assume that it's a load of crap and we have to sort out the fly turd from the pepper, as it
right.
were. Whereas with historic Christianity, it's like the opposite is true. Like I'm just gonna I do this thing in online arguments when I get in arguments with people. I do this thing where I'm just gonna take like the most like obtuse pro Bible view I can. You know, if someone wants to argue like long 6-day creation, I'm like, the earth is only 4,000 years old and St. Paul wrote the entire Bible.
Yeah, there you go.
And, you know, like the, like whatever, like the exact opposite of textual criticism is, like, that's what I'm doing.
And it was all written in the King James Version. Yeah.
It was, but, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I had an argument.
Through the book of maps. Yeah. It's all King James.
I had an argument with a guy on Twitter the other day and he kept talking about like, oh, well, what about this contradiction and what about that error and what about this and that and the other thing? And I was like, yeah, guy, I don't know what you're talking about, but I'm just reading the Bible. Do you need a copy? I can send you one.
That's I run into those frequently. I let others know that I'm a reverend online in my various platforms and fake names that I do. And people will come up and they'll have, you know, they'll go to whatever atheist, they'll go to Reddit and they'll, you know, go to atheist/atheism or whatever. I assume that's where they're all born. I don't go to Reddit for the same reason I don't use Instagram or TikTok, but yeah. So and then they'll come in, they'll, you know, haha, what about this contradiction? How can you this proves that the Bible is false because it's contrary. And they've got a list of, you know, 10 contradictions, or if they've got, you know, one of the websites that's collected all of the contradictions in the Bible. It's like a million contradictions and stuff. And you could go through, you would answer a contradiction, and they just move on to the next one. And the next time they have an argument with the same Christian, let's say they only make it 17 contradictions into their list, the next Christian they argue with, they'll start at contradiction number one again. You don't actually make any progress
right.
with these
things. Well, because
things.
They don't want to believe. They want hate. Yeah. They want to disbelieve. Yeah.
And this is, and so the more you pare down their list, the more you remove their justification for disbelief. They say, well, I can't believe because look at this impressive long list of all these things where the Bible contradicts itself. The problem is that Google is a thing. And if you Google their arguments and you Google their, you know, you search for their, you know, their contradictions, there are tomes written already addressing these things. Every time somebody comes up with, if God real, why bad thing happen, it just, it baffles the mind. It's just, have you not, you know, have you heard of the problem of evil before? Have you heard of the Epicurean paradox? Have you, you know, these things have been discussed for thousands of years. You're not the first. Yeah, exactly. So it's not, but they don't, a lot of time, I'm fine if somebody comes and they ask a question and they want to know the answer to it. But if they come and the questions are just ammunition, say, look, this is why the Bible isn't true. And they haven't done the due diligence to kind of look it up and see if they can find an answer. And they won't be interested in the answer if you give it to them, then it's a little bit more frustrating. At that point, I often would recommend to people not to just, you know, jump into ad hominem and insult them and make them cry, but also not necessarily to address their list of ammunition because it's reusable. Instead, there's an underlying reason for disbelief. I don't love apologetics. I think apologetics is extremely boring and irritating. It is very useful and you have to be good at it, but it's not the same as, I mean, it's a necessary step sometimes.
Here's an apologetics hot take. I don't think apologetics is useful for non-Christians. I think apologetics is good for Christians mm-hmm. who have doubts or fears or questions. That's where we should use apologetics. I don't think that using apologetics to argue some guy on Reddit's going to get you very far.
Well, if somebody could be convinced, could be brought to the faith through apologetics, then faith would be an intellectual accomplishment. Mm-hmm. It would be, you have to be smart. You can be smart enough to be argued into the faith. The reality is that faith is a supernatural thing, which is why even children can have it. I've got a video that's going to be coming out eventually saying, can stupid people be saved? And it's arguing against this concept of you have to make these, you have to intellectually understand something to have faith, but that's not the case. But I completely agree with you in terms of apologetics. It's often most useful to remove stumbling blocks for Christians. A Christian will say, well, I have faith. I trust that the Bible is true, but how do I reconcile it with this other thing? How do I reconcile it with carbon dating? How do I reconcile it with the time it takes, photons to travel from it? And you can use apologetics to say, look, this is how the system actually works. There's actually not a conflict with what you believe, what scripture says, and what this other source of information has. So I think the two uses of apologetics are primarily to remove stumbling blocks for Christians, to remove concerns and show them confidence that they can have in their faith, but also to identify vulnerabilities in other arguments. So if I'm arguing with somebody who absolutely refuses to believe, I will do my best to make it a public argument, not for their sake and not for my sake, but for the sake of the other people who are listening and trying to and they're taking in all the information. If you can use apologetics to then say, look, there's this massive hole in your armor right here, that person may not address it. That person may shift away from there, but everybody else just heard, wow, this is why this argument that this atheist makes, it falls flat. If it's, that's why you can argue about philosophically, you can argue about morality and you can say, objective morality has to have an objective moral lawgiver. You can't, if morality is subjective, then it's just preference. And once you explain that, that person may not be convinced and, fall on their knees and worship Christ. But the other people around may think, wow, that is a major flaw in this other person's belief system. I should learn more. I should talk to a pastor. I should read. And hopefully God works through that, because God is the one who's giving faith, not anybody's brilliance. But it's
correct.
It has its uses, but I don't want to say it's an evil. I was going to say it's a necessary evil. It's an often necessary tool, but it's not a tool of evangelism. It's not a tool of creating faith.
No, correct. Yeah. Correct. We have similar kind of personalities. I don't know if you know that. I saw one of your first videos that I ever saw of you. You had the aviators on and you were, steamrolling some stupid memes or whatever.
Those are people's favorites. I haven't made enough of those.
Oh, yeah.
Those are the most requested. The second most requested video, second most requested are the, do more Chad Priest destroys lame atheist arguments. The first requested video, brace yourself for this one. The first most requested video that I have is it a sin to be a furry?
Yes, it is.
Internet people are
needs
really
the answer to that. The answer
question.
Yeah, I'm sure they are.
I told people, I said, I will legitimately put in the effort to make a step by it would be easy to make a 10-second video, but to put in a step by step video, explaining every sort of aspect of that question, if you get me to 1,000 subscribers. So I told people, I said, at 1,000, this was back when I was at 200, so I didn't think it was ever going to happen. So now I'm starting to sweat as I'm getting closer to 1,000 subscribers and say, okay, now I've got to answer this question. And I've got to do so in such a way that it's patient and it's Christ-like, but it's also not compromising on the truth.
I think just my general rule of thumb, if you're asking, is it a sin to XYZ, just stop, because it probably is, right? If you have to ask,
That was the thing. I've got an entire series planned. I mentioned, I came up with a video just recently. I said, is it a sin to be asexual? Because there were people who were asking mm-hmm. me this, and they were, younger people were legitimately concerned. They heard this term at their school. They were there was one person who asked me, she was 12, and she asked me this. She says, is this a sin? And I explained to her, using the language of Paul talking about his, Paul's gift of singleness, but for her, it was this concept where this was an identity that people, you are assigned a sexual or a gender identity in school. If you don't fit into one of these, you know, one of these categories, you know, everybody fits into a category. What are your pronouns? What is your, you know, attraction level? And they try to make it more and more complicated. But for her, she was terrified that because she knew, she said, okay, well, I know, you know, homosexuality is a sin. I'm terrified because I'm not attracted to, you know, I'm not attracted to that activity and other people. She's 12. She shouldn't be. Right. It's good that she's not involved with that. But she had been told that this was a sexual identity, and sexual identities mean LGBTQIAP plus. And she knew that, she knew the aspect of sin in that. So she asked this question, expecting it fully to be a yes. And then she was going to have to struggle with, you know, how do I deal with this and that kind of thing. So this is me contradicting you, because you're right most of the time, in regards to that. If somebody says, is it a sin if I, and they're trying to see how close they can get to the line. And usually the motivation is to get to the line so that it's a sin just by the motivation. But the other question that I get, and this is more as a chaplain, a military chaplain, is it a sin to kill? And that's a question that Lutherans, they can answer that. We can answer that question. And at the end of the day, if there's some, this is something that I learned, having this answer, giving the answer over and over again, Luther wrote a book, he said, or a pamphlet on whether soldiers too can be saved. It's fantastic. He talks about, killing in war is like using a scalpel. You have to do violence to the body, but you save the body through the violence that's done. But talking with somebody, they had these regrets of these things that they did in the Vietnam War, and they legitimately did some bad things. They did some good things and they did some bad things. And the conclusion at the end of it all, at the end of, is it a sin to be asexual? Is it a sin to kill? Is it a sin to whatever? At the end of it, I realized how important it was to drive people back to the cross and say, whether or not it's a sin, whether or not there is an aspect of sin anywhere in here that you're not thinking about, whether or not you killed somebody and you had the right to kill him as a soldier, but you did not have the right mindset. You had a hateful, vengeful mindset when you did it, and somehow you tainted that action with your sin, with your sinful nature. Christ's blood has you covered. You are forgiven for that. Your walk away at the end of every single one of these questions needs to be, okay, I understand whether or not it's a sin now a little bit better, but the important part is that I am forgiven. And that's what it's so essential, and I hope I never forget this in any conversation, that people need to be able to walk away. And if they have questions, if they start thinking of questions later on, saying, but what if it is a sin because of this other aspect that I forgot to mention to the pastor? As long as they can turn back to the cross and say, but Christ died for me and paid for all of my sin, then that's a successful conversation.
That's awesome. That's such a great insight. Reverend, thank you so much for being here today.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Absolutely.
I try and keep them right around an hour, so we're like right there.
I won't start another tangent. I've got endless.
No,
I've got
a
whole binder full of those.
Well, I tell you what, I hope to have you back on and we can work our way through the binder.
Christian sure thing.
Combatives, that's your
Christian Combatives. That's it. Yeah. Christian Combatives on YouTube. We're the only ones named that. And we have no website. We have no Facebook. And so far it's just me, but I'm hoping to get some other pastors on there as well. Absolutely. I got one other pastor who's on there, but I'm hoping to get some more. Yeah.
Cool. Well, I'm hoping to push you over 1,000 so we can get that furry video.
Oh boy. Yeah. There's a group of people who are actually significantly large fans of me that I found out about recently who would object to your easy answer to that question. I don't know that they'll hear this
they're about the only group on the internet that I haven't upset by now. So it's coming anyway. You know, I'm due for it. So
yeah, it's fine. Yeah, you can get there. you'll get there. Yeah.
Pastor, thank you so much.
Yeah.